Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at BFL in Switzerland, and I will be your host today. Today we'll be talking to Gernot Wagner about the new book, Geoengineering the Gamble. Stabilizing the world's climates means cutting carbon dioxide pollution. There's no way around it. But what if that's not enough? Wagner explores scenarios of a geoengineered future, offering an inside view of the research already underway and the actions the world must take to guide it in a productive direction.
Gernot, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So how are you? How was your week?
This week was a bit crazy because I'm back in New York right now, but I just came back from Vienna, Austria, where I'm actually from, Austria at least, originally. There's quite a lot going on in the climate front right now, I can tell.
So can you tell us, what do you do?
Other than actually, and even there is sort of a lot happening as we speak that is sort of somewhat complete, you know, some sort of completely new. We're sort of hitting these tipping points left and right, and the positive ones. So for example, I have never been able to convince somebody who is, in fact, you know, paying for my flight right across the Atlantic, which causes, you know, half a ton of CO2 emissions, right? A ton round trip, a metric ton of CO2, to not just, right, sort of, you know, pay for the like $10 in carbon offsets to plant a tree somewhere, but to go all the way and basically pay for taking CO2 back out of thin air. Carbon removal, which, you know, is possible. It's energetically expensive. It is expensive. It costs a lot of money for good reason, right? It's, you know, hundreds of dollars in addition for the flight. And frankly, you know, very few of us, of course, do this sort of thing. And no, carbon offsets are not perfect, far from it, right? They encourage us to fly more, which is all bad, of course. But if one does buy a carbon offset, taking it back out and putting it underground is, of course, precisely what needs to happen. Sustainable aviation fuels are part of this to, in some sense, you know, have low carbon flights possible. That is very expensive, right? And well, in this case, and frankly, only in this case, I convinced somebody to basically, you know, pay for that, hundreds of dollars in additional costs for the flight, where I sort of said, look, if that doesn't happen, I wouldn't attend this particular engagement. We are now at a point where sort of consciousness is so high, sort of socioeconomic tipping points are being passed where it sort of becomes obvious that, yeah, that's precisely what a flight ought to cost. That's precisely what one must do. And it's so late in this climate policy game that it's no longer a choice. We have to do this. Those are all sort of the positive, the optimistic things, I would say. And of course, full disclosure, there are, of course, many, many pessimistic, many, many reasons for pessimism, right? It is so late. There's so many negative climatic tipping points. There are very, very good reasons, frankly, not to fly, to not emit the additional carbon because, well, climate change is bad. And frankly, what we don't know for the most part makes it much, much worse.
Oh, wow. Times are really changing.
right. No, we're not winning this climate fight, right? No stretch of the imagination, right? It is very, very late in this, to finally get emissions down. We are passing these positive, or we are approaching at least many of these positive socioeconomic tipping points as well.
So what do you study?
I'm a climate economist. I studied climate science or environmental science, policy, and economics. That was pretty much my undergraduate degree, actually, college degree. I did the same in graduate school, political economy. And I've frankly been doing this ever since, and it's been, I guess, 20 years by now.
And how did you get interested in studying climate?
Well, I guess, every teenager, I guess, right? So of course there is sort of many more, a much bigger movement, fortunately, in this direction, right? Fridays for Future and so on. When I was a teenager in the 90s, right? That was not, there were no Friday school protests, right? There was no Greta Thunberg, right? None of this. In some sense, even back then, that was sort of my most, the topic I was most interested in, right? The fairly big problem out there, even at the time, already recognized as such. In some sense, I've done nothing else ever since. I've always, I guess back then, very often it wasn't called climate economics, it was called environmental economics. So you studied broader environmental topics as well. And of course, they're still important, right? We must not ignore them either. But frankly, it's become increasingly clear that yes, climate is in fact a much bigger, much more important topic than, frankly, had been recognized, and in many ways is still being recognized as such. We must do much more than we currently do.
And during your career journey, did you have very supportive mentors, for example? And how was the whole sort of community around these topics?
I guess. 10, 20 years ago. Okay, I'm not that old. So I've been, I graduated from college in 2002, right? So 20 years. During those 20 years, 10, 20 years ago, especially in the business community. This topic was always out there, but it was never, you know, the core. It was never sort of the most important thing, right? Like the CEO priority here, right? Frankly, that has changed quite a bit. Now when the CEO of Accenture, a company, by the way, with 500,000 employees, which basically got its start and grew because of digitalization and outsourcing and so on. So, you know, when you ask the CEO of Accenture now, what's the big topic in the next 10 years? She will tell you sustainability. She will tell you, you know, climate, helping our clients and finding new clients and helping them decarbonize their operation, get ready for this transition, or for that matter, engage, truly engage in this transition to net zero emissions, and, you know, do this sooner rather than later, cut carbon as much as we can, as fast as we can. And no, it's not just up to the business community, of course, it takes policy, it takes much, much more than that. But yes, sort of the difference in conversations is certainly a big part of what I would call guarded optimism that that we are moving in this direction, in the right direction, not fast enough, of course not, but still.
And what would you say to students who might be interested in really studying this area?
Well, so I'm somewhat biased here, but it is certainly the most exciting, the most exciting overall topic with which one can engage, right? And then there are, of course, lots and lots of different angles, right? So whether you are, in college, in sort of a liberal arts degree, looking at lots and lots of different, looking at a topic through lots of different lenses, well, this is the sort of topic that lends itself to that. And you, if you're in business school, you know, engineering, economics, law, any one of these topics, yes, there is the sort of climate always looming in the background. And of course, it must not be in the background, right? It's the sort of topic that has lots and lots of interesting questions and, of course, is in need of good answers in all sorts of dimensions from all sorts of different angles. So I would certainly say, you know, if you choose a topic to focus on, this may well be the one, there should be, could be the one topic to focus on for your studies.
Nice, sold. So your latest book is Geoengineering: The Gamble. So how did you come to writing it?
Geoengineering, which often means different things to different people, but for me, it's mostly solar geoengineering, solar radiation management. It's basically attempting to create an artificial sun shield for the planet, right? Sort of cool the planet, lower temperatures, global average temperatures, through deliberate large-scale intervention. This topic is certainly a very, very uncomfortable topic, right? It is not, frankly, it's not a solution to climate change. Let's start with that. It is not the sort of thing you should be contemplating doing if it comes to addressing the root cause of climate change, because it's not addressing the root causes of climate change. It's a Band-Aid, it's a chemotherapy, it's whatever, it's whatever medical analogy you want to use. It's the sort of thing that you may want to consider. And I would certainly argue, I do argue in the book, that we should be doing the research to shed light on this important topic. But it is not the first line of defense. Far, far from it, right? Which makes it, it makes it a very uncomfortable topic, right? Because every minute you and I now talk about geoengineering, well, we don't spend it on cutting CO2 emissions in the first place. We don't talk about heat pumps and induction stoves and how important it is to cut, you know, the gas line to your home and to insulate and to electrify and to do all sorts of other things, to put the solar panel on the roof, to do all sorts of other things that are crucial, crucial parts of climate policy, of cutting CO2 emissions. Solar geoengineering is the sort of topic that, yes, we should study it more now. It may well be relevant, very relevant, all too relevant, sooner rather than later. But yeah, we are very much at the stage where the name of the game is, let's make sure we study it so we understand it as a potential intervention to lower global average temperatures, rather than something where, right, I would want to be seen as anything close to sort of an advocate that's, you know, who says, oh, we should be doing this now.
All right, so let's delve into some of this exciting science that you cover in your book. So you already touched upon it a little bit. So can you explain a bit more, what exactly does geoengineering mean in practical terms?
So I guess the most down-to-earth version of sort of trying to explain solar geoengineering for the planet is to look at, to call it what often is being covered sort of in middle school, high school science, looking at albedo, looking at how brighter surfaces that have a higher albedo, that are white, reflect more light back into space and therefore cool what is underneath, right? So the reason why, you know, your t-shirt in the summer is often white and your winter coat is black is because the darker a particular surface is, the more energy it it keeps, and the warmer what is underneath, the warmer the surface itself. Why do we wear white between Memorial and Labor Day? Well, because it cools what is underneath, right? Okay, so albedo effect is sort of the principle behind solar geoengineering. Now, of course, solar geoengineering is not as innocuous as you wearing a white t-shirt in the summer, right? Or a winter coat in the winter, right? It's the planetary version of this. And of course, you know, that comes with lots of potential risks. It also, of course, has a much, much larger impact, right? So brightening surfaces in a big way, actually, the sort of the urban version is, or the surface version, if you will, is painting roofs white cools the house below, right? Or painting surfaces, painting, sort of having lighter, brighter streets instead of, you know, black tar, having those surfaces be white even, well, reflects light, energy back into space and cools the local climate, right? So sort of the urban version, the city version, if you will, is, you know, paint a whole bunch of roofs white and you address the urban heat island effect. Right, how cities are often warmer in the summer or any time of the year than the surrounding countryside is called the heat island effect. Well, painting roofs white might be able to address that. Now, again, this is sort of the terrestrial version, if you will. So solar geoengineering, often, or the most prominent example of solar geoengineering is stratospheric aerosols, tiny reflective particles deliberately introduced in the stratosphere, like 20 plus kilometers up, so well beyond where current planes fly, for example. But to do so, basically in an attempt to, you know, lower global average temperatures. Now, how do we know this works? Well, volcanoes have been doing it forever. So when Mount Pinatubo erupts in the Philippines in 1991, global average temperatures within like 6 months or so decrease in that case, decreased by around half a degree centigrade and stayed that way for about a year. So the following year, global average temperatures in 1992, global average temperatures were about half a degree centigrade lower than what they would have been without this volcanic eruption in the Philippines in 91. And, you know, of course, the deliberate version here would certainly not include exploding volcanoes. Of course not. But the principle on the planetary scale is very similar.
So what kind of particles would that be if they were man-made?
Okay, so the volcanic version is sulfur dioxide released into the stratosphere in this case. So not every volcano, by the way, cools the planet this way. Only major volcanic eruptions would lead to this effect. If they were, in fact, you know, man-made, human-made, right, artificial, of course, we don't have to stop with the natural analog here. It would be possible to conceive of other options. One option often mentioned in this context, largely because it could have potential other positive properties, is calcium carbonate, limestone, sort of the stuff that's in your toothpaste, or, you know, rocks, limestone, which, you know, sounds a lot more innocuous than sulfur dioxide. It may also come with its own risks, of course, right? So once again, the name of the game here is to study it, not to talk about deployment, not to talk about actually doing it, but to, you know, to study what it might, what it might imply to do this. Yes, so it does not have to be the sort of substance that volcanoes release into the stratosphere. It could, in fact, involve other, not necessarily man-made substances, but still other other particles.
So what kind of risks can there be?
Many. So frankly, so first of all, when you look at this topic, it is it's very uncomfortable, frankly, most uncomfortable for those of us who actually talk about it, right, to do so, because yes, those ideas are, can be, and certainly often are taken out of context. One of the biggest risks has nothing to do with any potential physical risks, which are actually fairly limited, right? Just to be clear, right? So yeah, volcanoes have other nasty side effects. But, you know, in this case, we're not talking about a volcanic eruption like Mount Pinatubo, which, you know, did kill a few hundred people in the Philippines because it was a major volcanic eruption, right? The physical risks of basically getting radiative forcing, getting the impact of the sun's rays on the Earth's surface, getting that down a tiny, tiny bit, lowering global average temperatures, the sort of broader physical risks are actually fairly limited, in the sense that the raw benefits of lowering global average temperatures vastly, vastly exceed the costs of doing so. Yes, there are costs, and I'm not just talking about sort of the narrow engineering costs of, you know, designing a sort of a plane that doesn't exist yet, with a sort of large fuselage and massive wingspan that is would be able to deliver any of these substances into the stratosphere. No, it's sort of the broader costs here, right? For monitoring, for actually setting up a system like this. And then, yes, the sort of the potential physical cost as well. Still, the benefits far outweigh the cost, as far as we know right now, as far as science knows right now. What's the risk then? What's the real risk? To me, I would say the real risk here has very little to do with these physical impacts. The real risk is that we, society, vested interest, politicians use this topic, use solar geoengineering as yet another excuse not to cut CO2 emissions in the first place. Right? Basically, yet again, we have a topic where it's pretty clear who would be the vested interest, right? Who would be most interested in pointing to this possibility, this technology, potential technology, and say, hey, solution found. We don't need to do anything else, right? Here's a techno fix that will fix it all, so we don't need to do anything else. That would be, frankly, it would be a mistake, just to be clear. It would be wrong. It is not a solution to climate change. And frankly, it would be very easy to see how this sort of topic could be taken out of context, would be taken out of context to achieve this.
That is really interesting, the way you said earlier that solar engineering can be thought of as a band-aid rather than the full sort of solution to the climate crisis. So in what scenarios can we think of solar engineering as a part of our efforts?
So ideally, and to be clear, this is maybe the one too rational view here. I certainly presented as that in my book, is to have solar geoengineering be part of actually what you might call sort of the world's most rational approach to climate change. And of course, the reason, right, why we are here, why climate is still a problem, of course, is because we are not approaching this anywhere close to rationally. First of all, the big question is, right, who the we is in this case, right? You and I might come up with the most rational thing to do here, but of course, you know, that's not how the world runs, turns out. But in this world, in this scenario, of us, you know, very, very quickly getting around to doing just the right things, cutting CO2 emissions, adapting to climate change, removing carbon from the atmosphere to go back closer to pre-industrial levels, right? Doing all of that. Yeah, solar geoengineering may well play a role, a small role, but a role nonetheless, in helping mitigate, helping decrease the total impact that humans have had on the world's climate, and to do so temporarily, right? So if eventually, if the goal is to get CO2 concentrations and other greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere back to where they were pre-industrial levels, then, you know, at that stage, right, solar geoengineering is no longer needed, right? We don't want to, right, lower global average temperatures beyond where they had been in this sort of amazing 10,000 year span or so of human civilization, where we've seen amazingly stable climates conducive to the sort of human development we have seen, human flourishment. So solar geoengineering in this very rational scenario might come in as part of a balanced, broad climate policy portfolio. And basically then, you know, sooner rather than later, go away, no longer needed. Thank you very much. Now, the way I described it, hopefully came across as, look, the world just isn't run this way. Right, we can't hope for solar geoengineering to be used in this very, very rational way, which of course immediately raises the question of, you know, how does the world look? How is the world run? What could we do to address some of the real world questions through a possible addition of solar geoengineering to our climate policy toolkit?
So most of us think of solar geoengineering as a truly global endeavor. So if you release particles in one place, they're quite likely to be carried through the atmosphere to a different place on Earth. So can it work more on a local level as well?
So I would be very cautious here and would tend to say that No, right? I mean, the very local version, right, where you use the same principle and sort of try to cool your home by painting the roof white. Yes, of course, that can certainly work. And frankly, should be part of our approach to how we address climate change. The sort of local targeted intervention that changes local climates, you know, sort of in a broader way, but well beyond your own home or your own city, I think is much more difficult. Now, there is some research happening there too. So for example, there's a potential idea called marine cloud brightening, which is, as the name suggests, brightening of marine clouds. About 10% or so of the planet is covered by these clouds. Ship tracks, actually, right? Sort of the emissions coming out of major ships crisscrossing the oceans also artificially generate some of these clouds. And yes, those clouds have a cooling effect on the local climate. And, you know, one of the questions is, okay, maybe we can brighten these clouds to reflect even more sunlight back. What might that do? There's some research ideas around the Great Barrier Reef, right? So you have many of the coral reefs, right, being very much affected by climate change, not just temperatures, by the way, but ocean acidification as well. Okay, so what about a targeted intervention brightening marine clouds right above the barrier reef to cool sea surface temperature around this particular coral reef? Honestly, I don't think that that is a scalable idea. But frankly, there too, you know, just because of my opinion doesn't mean we shouldn't be studying this topic, shouldn't frankly try everything to in fact help save the barrier reef. And yes, a more local version, marine cloud brightening in this case, may well be part of this solution, right? So that's sort of the intermediate step. It's not as global as stratospheric aerosols at a truly global level. It's certainly not as local as your sort of local intervention painting roofs, right?
So what kind of experiments have there been performed, perhaps on a slightly smaller scale rather than going global?
Frankly, most, the vast, vast majority of the research on solar geoengineering is either in computers, that's the vast majority, or some studies have been done in labs. So the vast, vast majority of those, you know, computer model runs, it's basically climate model runs, right? Which makes me so comfortable with the fundamental conclusions coming out of those studies is that it's basically the same models that tell us that climate change is happening in the first place and what the implications are, right? So high temperatures will rise and so on. Those exact same models, that exact same knowledge when applied to solar geoengineering model runs tells us that, yeah, there is the potential for solar geoengineering to in fact do some good. It would lower global average temperatures. It would bring temperatures closer to pre-industrial levels, and it would do the same for a whole host of other things that we care about. So it's not just average temperatures, it's extreme heat days, right? It's temperature extremes. It's precipitation, or I guess more specifically, precipitation minus evaporation, right? So basically the water left over. Well, same thing there. The world would potentially go closer to where it was pre-industrial. Now, once again, right, the biggest objection immediately is, wait, wouldn't it be better to just cut CO2 emissions? And the short answer is yes, it would. Mm-hmm. should have done that a long time ago, right? We shouldn't be having this conversation today. There wouldn't be a need to have this conversation if we had to, you know, started cutting CO2 emissions in the 90s or 80s or right sort of 1980s, right? Sort of whenever we sort of were sure that yes, adding CO2 causes global warming, and we are able to quantify the effects, and we realize that they are costs, and therefore we must pay for these costs when we emit CO2, and if we pay for these costs, we emit less CO2, right? Sort of this whole chain, of course, you know, again, in a rational world, we wouldn't even be having this climate problem. We, you know, we would have emitted some CO2 because, right, it took us a while to get around to realize that climate change is in fact a real problem, but frankly, it didn't take us into the 2020s to realize that, right? The sort of the fundamental science was done in the 19th century, by the way, right? Mid 1850s, we knew that those effects existed, but of course, then we really knew, you know, mid 20th century, and lots of science has been done since then. So we have much greater confidence now. But there was no excuse not to act in the 1990s, for example, 1992, the time of the very first Rio Earth Summit, right? The conversation was very much around sustainability, about ensuring a flourishing, you know, future for all. How do you do this? Well, one element, cutting CO2 emissions and doing so quickly. And once again, right, we didn't follow this path, and therefore we have conversations right now, even about something as potentially as scary as potential solar geoengineering interventions.
So let's pretend that we live in semi-perfect world where we started to cut our CO2 emissions, but we still would like to use some sort of solar geoengineering. So who would you have to engage, so in terms of policy, for example, or public, and how would you go about to making it come true?
Well, frankly, I think you just called it. The most important thing is having discussions, debates even, about the efficacy, the risks, the opportunities of looking at this particular technological intervention. And, you know, governance is sort of this term of art used. I mean, frankly, to me, governance basically means just having the right kind of conversations. But yes, those should happen. And again, not about deploying solar geoengineering anything close to at scale now. No, those conversations should be about how to do the research, doing the research, of course, both sort of the natural scientific research and, of course, social sciences as well, right? What are the broader implications? And frankly, we should also use this opportunity, the need to talk about solar geoengineering research, for example, as an opportunity to, frankly, engage people about climate change in the first place and the need for climate policy. Right, so yeah, there's this very real fear, what's often called moral hazard, that when you talk about solar geoengineering, that you detract from the need to cut emissions in the first place. Sure. Well, the inverse may hold true as well. The inverse being that when you have these conversations, when you talk about solar geoengineering, some people may well, hopefully, wake up to the fact that, wait, if serious people are talking about this particular potential technology, maybe there is something to this climate change problem after all, right? So mere conversation about solar geoengineering research may well serve as a wake-up call of sorts, basically telling people, engaging people on this topic and saying, hey, we ought to be doing more on this topic, and maybe doing so could, in fact, help us get to a somewhat more rational climate policy in the first place.
So what would you like to see in the future?
Frankly, more conversation. That's a good starting point. Now, when I say more conversation, right? So, of course, let's put it this way. You know, many, many more, much more conversation, much more engagement on cutting CO2 emissions in the first place, on resiliency, on adaptation, on all sorts of different climate aspects, right? We are not yet doing enough to address climate change, to address global warming. Of course not. And then, yes, also focused on solar geoengineering research now, also some conversations that talk about the potential need for that particular technological intervention, and frankly, how scary it is, how many risks there are, how it is not a solution to climate change, and how therefore we must cut CO2 emissions much, much more than frankly most of us think is in fact necessary.
And now reflecting a little bit on us as a society. So how optimistic are you that we will be able to tackle all of these big issues and come to our senses, really?
Well, that's sort of the very short version of an answer I would give you, which is it's too late for pessimism. Right? Now, okay, of course, right? Your reaction, of course, was the exact right one, right? So, it sounds good in a pithy, you know, interview maybe, but of course there is, you know, really what it means is it is very, very late, right? It is. Is it true then that, you know, is it possible to be optimistic because of how late? And frankly, I'm by nature an optimist. I think it's good to be optimistic. I think it's good to wake up in the morning and look at potential solutions as opposed to first listing all the problems, of course, right? How else to get out of bed in the morning? On the other hand, of course, right? Sort of the big problem here is there are some climate wins and they're important ones on all sorts of dimensions. There are these positive socioeconomic tipping points, technological tipping points, all sorts of tipping points that we are crossing, and that's good. And then there are the negative ones. Then there are the massive climatic tipping points that are frankly extremely costly when left unaddressed, right? When we don't tackle climate change, carbon emissions. There's the sort of the way of looking at them is that looking at those, you know, low probability, high impact events on the one hand, looking at tipping points, potential for crossing these negative tipping points on the other, and so on, all of those put together must push us in one and only one direction, which is we have to do much, much more to address climate change than we currently do. And on balance, right, is it then appropriate? Is it good to be optimistic? Well, that's difficult, right? That's it's very difficult to say that, oh yeah, look, we are tackling this, we are addressing climate change, we're doing it, we are not. There are plenty of climate damages already built in. There's a tenth of humanity on the subcontinent, in India, currently, over the past few weeks, living through a massive, massive heat wave. Heat waves, frankly, sort of a series of weather events, all, of course, related, all correlated, and all very much linked to climate change, right? So this is not some future event. Climate change is not some far-off idea here that, you know, oh, it's going to get bad soon. No, it is bad, right? People are dying as we speak because of climate change. That's the pessimistic view, right? So sort of we are certainly failing at solving climate change as we speak. Are we, in fact, looking at a world where we are going to be doing more in the future and where that is enabled by newer, better, cheaper technologies, better ways of organizing ourselves? a society, individuals realizing that they must do more, governance realizing, businesses realizing, interplay of policy and individual action and so on. Yes, a lot more needs to happen there. And frankly, you know, we see some wins that do, in fact, move in the right direction here too, of course.
Some healthy dose of reality there.
Yes, I just wanted to, it's good to keep two feet in the real, on the ground here, right, in the real world. And actually, right, so there's always this sort of idea of sort of contrasting sort of the world how it should be, right, what sort of activists would say, hey, this is what we must do in order to solve these problems, and sort of, you know, the world how it is. And frankly, to call one of them, one of those reality and the other one, you know, sort of activism. And I would say, like, you know, no, I mean, there must be a distinction, of course, between, hey, how things are and how things could or should be, of course. But it's also clear that you can have both of these ideas in your head at the same time. Right, have 2 feet in the real world and describe the world as it is, and do so properly, right? While at the same time have, you know, well-formed opinions based on science that tell us how the world should be, what we as society, as politicians, policymakers should be doing to move in a direction that, in fact, it creates the greatest well-being for the, you know, the greatest common good here. And yes, addressing climate change is very much part of that equation.
Oh, yes, for sure. And especially from the public's point of view, just not to get paralyzed into inaction by all of this doom and gloom.
Exactly, right? And frankly, that's, you know, that's a key bit too, right? Sort of some of this is a bit of self-preservation, right? Sort of if all you do all day long, right, is worry about the negative tipping points and the negative side effects. I mean, again, that's important, right? And yes, we must recognize that there is a nightmare, a collective nightmare, before, you know, we pursue the dream, right? And sort of look at the positive, the optimistic version. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's the optimistic version that, in fact, makes us want to get up out of bed in the morning, makes us, want to act and so on. And it's this optimism, the fact that, yes, we can, in fact, address this problem, right? This is not doom and gloomism, not at all. But yeah, getting that balance right is, of course, important.
So what discoveries in your research for your book, Geoengineering, surprised you the most?
I guess what is often surprising to me is how many people have very strongly held opinions. And in this case, I would say mostly on the negative side of things, while the science, those hundreds of climate model runs, thousands of climate model runs, hundreds of peer-reviewed papers looking at the potential for solar geoengineering actually point to quite a bit of potential. And how then scientists, senior scientists, very good scientists, often say, yeah, you know, I believe the science, sure. And, you know, it's not a question of belief, but I trust the science. While at the same time, frankly, often having sort of fairly knee-jerk reactions that say, oh, but I just don't like it. I would not want to do this. It just sounds like something that we shouldn't touch. It sounds crazy. And actually, you know, I would agree. It sounds nuts. You know, there might be a slight distinction between nuts and crazy, but let's not get into that particular linguistic distinction. But yeah, it sounds nuts, right? Like really, like create an artificial sun shield for the planet, right? Like sounds nuts. Well, yeah. And that, you know, sort of skepticism is healthy. That reaction is healthy. Absolutely. But, then, well, we do have a thing called scientific process, right? Where we do live in a world where, you know, at least, you know, not all of us, of course, right? So, you know, look out the window, but where those of us engaged in scientific dialogues and, you know, science-based policy making and so on, frankly, look to the evidence first, the facts, the science, to try to guide the sort of policy conversations that we are having. And when you do that, solar geoengineering looks perhaps surprisingly good. Now, that should not give us the comfort to say, oh, looks like it's a good idea to do. No, it may not be. There's some very good reasons to believe why it's not. But it's also clear that we must, in fact, draw this distinction between, frankly, what the natural science, this climate, the climate model runs and so on, tell us on the one hand, and, you know, the broader idea of having solar geoengineering be part of any sort of climate policy portfolio on the other. Yes, of course, there are big differences. Yes, of course, there are many, many, many other things to consider when contemplating this potential intervention. Sure. But it doesn't mean that we get to misrepresent the science. It doesn't mean that we get to say, hey, it's a bad idea. Science says so. Because if anything, science says the exact opposite. So, right, again, this is very, very much a difficult conversation to have, but it is an important one, and it's important enough for us to make clear that there are distinctions between, frankly, how many of us think the world should be, ideally, what we think should happen, versus, yeah, what, frankly, what the world thinks should happen. Right. What the world thinks should happen in the sense of, you know, democracy. Right. What the majority of people want to happen on the one hand, and on the other, what the world thinks should happen in the sense of how political forces, you know, market forces, right, sort of fundamental economic forces, right, wishes and desires of individuals added up, how they help shape the world. And yeah, right, none of this is easy. None of this is simple. None of this is comfortable often, but having the conversations is in fact crucial.
Well, let's hope that the next solar geoengineering project or solution is not going to be like the one in Futurama where they had like a dish reflecting sun into the space, and then the shield just turned around and focused the sunbeam into one spot, just incinerating everything on the way.
Yes, I think we can all agree that that would be somewhat unfortunate and maybe just a tad bit unrealistic too.
Let's hope so. Well, this has been a truly fascinating discussion. So can you tell us, what are you currently working on and what will be your next project?
That's a loaded question. Right now I'm in the process of transitioning from NYU, New York University, where I've been now for, 3 years by now, to Columbia Business School. So I've been on leave now from NYU for a semester, but I'm now this fall, permanently moving to Columbia Business School. Right, so that may not be such a big deal, right? So, you know, who cares, right? So you go from one university to the other, right? How does that matter? Well, in this case, actually, it does quite a bit in the sense that I've never been at a business school before. I've always worked at policy schools. Okay, why does this matter? Well, because, you know, business schools, for good reasons, and for better or worse, have a very different approach, a very different focus, how you look at the world. And maybe sort of the most sort of dramatic one, maybe, this is sort of my own experience now having taught of a very brief course here at Columbia Business School this past semester, is sort of your average student interaction. All right, so when you teach a class on climate policy, climate politics, climate economics, climate science for that matter, the vast majority of interactions with students are about the problems. And to be clear, there are many, right? No question. My interactions with students at the business school were the vast majority of them about the solutions. It was basically sort of this optimistic thing about, hey, MBA graduate to be, have a deep background in real estate finance, right? So what I've worked on in the past is, how to manage real estate deals. And now I went to business school and I'm taking your class now on climate change, climate policy, the energy transition. And I'm really, really passionate about climate policy. Really passionate about climate change, really passionate about being part of the solution. And I, because of my background in real estate, would like to use my knowledge, focus on solving this particular piece of the puzzle, sort of the missing link, linking finance and real estate investors and sort of, fixing the sort of contracts that lead to the sort of, excess emissions in the way we run our offices, office buildings, for example, right? Okay, so, very detailed example, long story, very specific too, but I hope it gives you sort of a sense of the kind of approach that says, no, I'm not going to work on fixing policy in a big way, right? Massive problem. And yes, we must do that too, of course. And frankly, policy schools are good at that. Are doing that, are focused on that. Whereas, the business school approach is often much more detailed, much more focused on a specific problem, and much more solution-oriented as well, focused on the specific solution to a specific problem. And, maybe that's where some of my optimism comes from as well, right? Which is basically the sort of this worldview that says, yeah, lots and lots of problems out there, but frankly, lots of young, very engaged people working on the solutions. And moving to a business school as a teacher, as a professor, in this case, allows you to engage with, teach students who are very much interested in finding, working on, being entrepreneurs in these areas that are basically providing solutions to important problems. And that's exciting, right? That's a big change in my case. It's an exciting one. I'd like to think it's an important one. And in some sense, it also sort of foretells a broader story here, right? Not to make too much of my own personal move here, but sort of this broader positioning where, frankly, the CEO of Accenture, right, who I mentioned before, right? When she says that, yeah, we might have grown in the past and been very successful because we work on outsourcing and digitalization and, hey, look, the internet, all these opportunities, right? Yeah, well, the next decade, sustainability, a full-on focus on decarbonization. Is that alone going to solve all the world's problems? Can we trust business leaders to solve massive public policy problems? Of course not, right? It takes this interplay of policy and businesses developing the solutions and technology and individual behavior and, of course. And frankly, policy, of course, is often the ultimate goal here, right? But yes, it is fascinating to watch this broader change in society that, in fact, has business leaders who frankly, right, whose job it is to run their business, right, who have fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders, who look at sustainability, decarbonization, the energy transition, the mobility transition, the broader topic of addressing climate change as being core to their future endeavors. That's exciting.
Oh, congratulations. That sounds amazing.
Thank you.
So what would be the best way for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your book?
Well, my name is unique enough. If you just Google it, I think you'll find quite a lot. But so gwagner.com is where my book is, my books are, and frankly, lots and lots of public writing, op-eds, commentaries, essays, 2,000-word essay in New York Magazine on how I decarbonized my own apartment and so on. And then, of course, lots of my academic work as well. That's a good place to start.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Galina. This was fun.